So I appreciate your comment about practice because it helps us focus down to the issues we're talking about designing and facilitating, you know, groups of people with a particular intent. And what is our approach to it? And when you think about a network, it scales, but it scales beyond your influence as a facilitator quickly. A community has some, you have some ability to have some influence on it. And sometimes you want that influence, and sometimes that influence is not useful. And, you know, you can only facilitate so far. But in networks, you create conditions for things to happen, and things emerge in that network. So they're out of your control. Now, that we think communities are in our control is also self-delusional, so I'll put that on there. But I think also, as we struggle with these words, it's not to diminish human connection of any form, and people have significant human connection in all those forms, including sometimes just with themselves, that you can have a significant relationship with someone in a network.
The priest said that, sir.
It's not that you have a absolutely shared, significant connection with everybody in that network in the same way. Whereas in a community, there's a greater likelihood, not a certainty. And in a dysfunctional community, you're going to, maybe it's the opposite of a relationship. It's not this. So, it's a framework to think about your strategy, but it's not a resolution of some deep human questions about how we relate to each other. It does not succeed in that realm, my friend. It doesn't. It's more on a practical level. The ephemeral nature of community day versus perhaps what it was before.
Yeah.
But one thing I just want to bring up here before I forget, which you also bring up the concept of legitimate peripheral participation, which is the lurker or the person who sits at the periphery of the community and has a meaningful experience, a useful experience.
Yeah.
Are they having a network experience or a community experience? You could argue either way. But it's an important part of it, and it's why that boundary is not so clear. And I also appreciate this idea that I'm not saying that the human part is impractical. When I try and talk about the practice of facilitation in communities of practice, I need to have some sort of language to define the context I'm working on so that you and I can understand what we're talking about. It's a limited language. It's a limited language, but I need a starting point. I need an affordance, a handle, so that we can start figuring out the differences and similarities across these forms, even if we can't even agree fully on what those forms are.
So this is this is a beautiful quote, but we can go past it, what I would call distributed leadership.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So we think about, instead of a hub-and-spoke model, if we want to scale both our own personal investment and energy in a community and people's participation, is that we can actually sustain better when we have diversity of leadership in different roles, and also when we move across those roles. Because sometimes over-specialization of a role in a community leads to ruts. And, you know, the heaven and hell of communities is when a community is moving together, there's something incredibly powerful about it. When it's seeing, it's setting its own learning agenda, when it's discovering its practice, when it's refining its domain, it is just like, it's a rush. When a community gets to a point when it's so used to its domain and everybody always does the same thing, pretty soon it becomes useless because either you're reflecting on the same thing over and over again and not moving forward, and you're just in your same ruts, and you fall into actually lots of thinking fallacies, practice fallacies, and, you know, you don't have much there. Or the other extreme is where you have dominating leadership and it's called a cult, where you have absolute uniformity of thought as a condition of participation. And communities of practice are not all beautiful, flowery things, you know? They can be used for a great deal of harm and evil in this world, however you want to define that. I know that was just a judgment statement. This perspective of Fred Kaufman, if you're interested in leadership that is distributed within each of us, the work of Fred Kaufman is really lovely. But I think this reflects the shift in my facilitation practice as I've aged and had more experience, which is do less. Get out of the way. Disrupt patterns to see what emerges without hurting people. But it's not about making nice for everyone. And making nice for everyone doesn't always create conditions for learning. Another thing is to have people think of things from an opposite perspective as you may have thought. So it's a technique called reverse brainstorming, which enables people to enter into an idea and gives them permission to absolutely not have to represent what you expect from them. And that can be very liberating. So if you're interested in the very word you used, Keith McCandless has been writing about liberating structures, and he's looking at a variety of methods that you actually bring people through quite rapidly that cause them to shift their
perception and their participation. Keith McCandless, McCandless, Liberating Structures. And he's drawn from various facilitation methods, and we're experimenting with using them both online and offline as community facilitation. He also works with the Plexus Institute, which is an organization that's looking at the role of complexity in healthcare. And the other thing, you know, when we struggle with this individual community network thing is we're struggling now with a space that technology has let us see some of the complexity that was there, but we didn't really notice it. And so what we're noticing is that we have to do different things than we may have done before or than we may have noticed before, and they fall into these general buckets for me. So this is my interpretation. This is one lens on these roles. And the first is to discover, and these are not in order, to discover and appropriate useful technology. And again, go back to this idea that when people discover a tool, they tend to use it more than if it is shoved in their face. So really thinking about how you create discoverability, a path of discoverability for them using those tools. And the second is that not creating so much structure around tool use that they cannot change it to work for them. So that's the individual affordance. It's not always a group affordance, sometimes it's an individual affordance. And what is useful to them may be different than what's useful to you. So when I am thinking about community leadership and I'm thinking about technology choices, it should not be done as a solo practice because you need to get the multiple perspectives. And you should explore how people do use tools. You will often be surprised at how different it is when you use those tools. And by making that visible, you broaden the possibilities for everybody in the community right now. Because some people only know one of those things. They don't know how to be in community. They've been lone wolves. Maybe, you know, there's a guy, I don't know if you read the work of Stephen Downs, who writes this amazing ongoing summarization of what's happening in the educational, technology, philosophy, pedagogy world. Brilliant guy. He and I have been locking horns for years now about community, and it's interesting, his dialogue is slightly shifting now. But he felt that community was a bad thing, that it was exclusionary, and it was, you know, a place where people abused power upon each other. Well, in conversation with Stephen one day, I said, we have to have this conversation face to face. We were talking about love, because I have part of my practice is, how does love show up or not? Stephen, something happened to you sometime in your life that makes you talk about community this way. He says, yeah, I was bullied as a child, horribly. So his worldview was so incredibly informed by what happened to him as an adolescent that it has colored his entire thinking about these forms. Now, interestingly, what happened was when networks emerged, he could see his experience with people in a new way. And now he actually talks about community as not necessarily, you're laughing because you've seen this as a bad thing. So people often have perceptions about the way they can interact and learn with each other. So a community of practice for you is not a community of practice for me until we figure out what we're talking about. So the discussion about how we participate cannot dominate our domain, otherwise we'll never get anything done. But it's a useful thread, and it's interesting when I work with younger people, they're very astute about noticing this stuff. And as I work with older people, they're very resistant to talk about it because they think we all know this and it's common knowledge. But when they actually start talking about it, they find out, no, we don't know what we're talking about here. And there really are some new possibilities. That's an age generalization. Take it lightly because, of course, it varies across that as well. The third is to express their identity. And you know, there's two pieces to this. One is digital identity and people understanding the impacts of leaving digital artifacts in the world and how they accumulate. How people see themselves, for example, in the community of practice, how they see themselves as a practitioner. And what I found when working with elementary school teachers, they're very isolated in their classrooms. They don't have a lot of sense of themselves as a professional because they're so buried in the classroom. So their identity as a group of professionals can be woven through participation with other teachers. So this is an example of identity. Find and create content. Remember I said in networks often we're finding each other via content, but it's also the act of creation of content that's very powerful about creating your voice in the world, about your mark in the world, and I could go on and on for that, but I won't. And then finally, to usefully participate. And that gets down to like the six hats would be an example of how to usefully participate. We also have people who actually mobilize, galvanize, form direction. There's a time for that. There's a time for not doing that. There are the people who are finding
and scanning for and finding the useful technologies that enable people to do what they need to do together, and we'll talk about that a lot this afternoon, they're the people who are connecting across the networks. And more, you know, if I were had a company and I hired people, I would actually screen talent for whether they're network weavers or not, because I think this is, in our world, a really hugely important, undervalued, and under-articulated role. And finally, in our communities, how are we nurturing the independent thinkers? Those may be the people on the periphery, connected out to the networks, but to keep from going into a convergent zone where nothing really moves forward, you need the independent thinkers. And in communities, sometimes it's harder making space for those people. So giving them a role. I mean, the participation that you offered today, and it would strike me as the importance of the role of an independent thinker to get us to question what we're blah, 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 or to see it in a new way, or to question how we're using terms. Things like that, those are really important roles. And we need to appreciate, validate, make space for these emerging roles, and not all in one person. No one person can do all these things. As the community of people, or the network of people, and we could dispute that and talk about it, because I really don't know, who care about this topic, develop their practice in this region, how can it be useful to itself?